Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Hi, everybody. I'm Stesha Brandon. I'm the Literature and Humanities Program Manager here at the Seattle Public Library, and welcome to the Central Library and to tonight's event with Dr. Mario Livio. We would like to thank our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and the Seattle Times for their generous support for library programs. We are also grateful to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Private gifts to the foundation from thousands of donors help the library provide free programs and services that touch the lives of everyone in our community. So if any of you are donors to the Library Foundation, thank you so much for your support. Now I am delighted to introduce Mario Livio, an internationally known astrophysicist, a best-selling author, and a popular speaker. Dr. Livio has appeared on The Daily Show, 60 Minutes, and Nova. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He is the author of many books, including The Golden Ratio, a highly acclaimed book for which he received the International Pythagoras Prize and the Peano Prize. He's also the author of The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved, Is God a Mathematician?, which was the basis for the 2016 Emmy-nominated NOVA program, The Great Math Mystery, and the national bestseller Brilliant Blunders, as well as The Accelerating Universe. Dr. Livio is going to give a presentation, and then he'll take questions from the audience, and then he's going to sign books right over at this table here. So here tonight to talk about his new book, Why? What Makes Us Curious? Please help me welcome Dr. Mario Livio.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be in Seattle, although I must say that traffic has become horrendous since the last time I've been here, which was 4 years ago with my previous book. So I'm going to talk about curiosity tonight. And I'm an astrophysicist, neither a psychologist nor a neuroscientist. So why did I decide to write a book about curiosity? The answer is actually very, very simple. I'm a very, very curious person myself, and so I became very curious about curiosity. And so I spent almost 5 years now, looking at all the research that has been done on curiosity, and I interviewed many people, I interviewed many researchers, I visited labs, and so on. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I do. By the way, I walk a lot because I have ADHD, so I'm not standing at the podium. So don't be alarmed. I would also ask for the lights to be somewhat lowered at the risk of this raises the melatonin level, but you will see better the screen. You see how it brings out the real colors of this. Now, in case you're just wondering about this particular abstract painting, well, inside it hides the question mark that is on the cover of the book. So this is the question mark that comes after why. So let's start, and I will start the way I start the actual book. With this author, it's very appropriate because we are inside the library. Kate Chopin is an American author from the 19th century. She lived in Louisiana much of her life. She wrote mostly short stories, but also a couple of novels. She married a Frenchman, Oscar Chopin. And the reason that I start with her is that because I encountered this short story by her, which is called The Story of an Hour. And you see, the story is so short, in fact, that it could fit on less than one page in Vogue when it was published in 1894. This, by the way, is her husband. That's the house in which she lived. Why did I like this short story so much? Well, it's a wonderful short story, but I was especially taken aback by the opening sentence. The first sentence in this short story says, "Knowing that Mrs. Mallard was afflicted with a heart trouble, great care was taken to break to her as gently as possible the news of her husband's death." You can hardly start a short story with a better sentence than this. I mean, this is, you know, there is death here and human frailty all packed into this one punchy sentence. So, and this is really her great gift of Kate Chopin. She is able, with every sentence, to produce some sort of an intellectual cliffhanger that, you know, you want to continue to read and so on. So I really like this. By the way, that's her in the background with four of her children. Oddly enough, I found one biography of her that said that she had six children and another one that said seven children. I'm convinced that she knew exactly how many children she had, but apparently some of the biographers didn't know. Okay, let's start. There was this psychologist, Daniel Berline. He was a British-Canadian psychologist who at some point decided that he wants to map curiosity on a two-dimensional plane. And he gave names to various types of curiosity. In particular, he gave these names: perceptual curiosity, epistemic, diversive, and specific. I will explain what each one of these means. But his goal in doing this was that he then thought that every type of curiosity you have can somehow be placed on this map, you know, that it belongs in that quadrant or that quadrant and so on. Now, what are these things? What is perceptual curiosity? I mean, he defined them, yes, but what did he mean by that? Perceptual curiosity is the curiosity you feel when you see something that surprises you, something that does not agree with things you thought you knew before, or something that's ambiguous in some way. I mean, look at this. These Asian children have seen for the first time in their life a white girl. Before that, they didn't even know that such a thing exists. And look at their faces. Look at their eyes. That's perceptual curiosity, okay? What is epistemic curiosity? Which is at the opposite of that. Epistemic curiosity is our true love of knowledge. That's what drives scientific research. That's what drives the greatest artists. That drives the question why, which is the title of this book. That's epistemic curiosity. Look at these children, you know, trying to see a scientific experiment and how it works and what does it do, how these plants grow, why they grow, and things like that. That's epistemic curiosity. Then on the other axis, I remind you, there was diversive and specific. What is diversive curiosity? Diversive curiosity is this. Look at these Dutch children. These Dutch children sit next to one of the greatest masterpieces of Western art. This is Rembrandt's The Night Watch in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. Not one of them looks at the painting. They are all searching for text messages. That's diversive curiosity, okay? This is basically the things you do to ward off boredom and, you know, to find all the time things. This is also the type of thing that people do when, you know, they wait for the new smartphone model to appear and wonder what is going to be in it and so on. Oddly enough, believe it or not, this same, very same painting at the Rijksmuseum, The Night Watch, was also actually the subject for very strong perceptual curiosity, that surprise and so on, under other circumstances. And I want to show you now that. Look here. Don't be alarmed, it comes from that.
Shoppers in the Dutch city of Breda get more than they bargained for after actors storm the shopping center dressed in 17th century outfits.
This is the 17th, this is in a shopping mall. Look, inside the shopping mall. You should look at the faces of the people who watch this. Here, look at all the faces of the people who watch. Look, even this kid.
Abseiling from ropes and jumping from balconies, the group was staging a reconstruction of Rembrandt's painting, The Night Watch, to promote the reopening of the Rijksmuseum.
So, you see, the same painting, The Night Watch, in this case, was staged of strong perceptual curiosity, okay? Finally, there is specific curiosity. Specific curiosity It's just that thing when you're curious about a very specific piece of information. Like, you know, what was the name of the actor in that film? You know, you go like this. Or like, who is this? Does anybody know? Yeah, Ernest Hemingway. That's right. So, but that's that type of curiosity. Who is this person? Okay, here he is in 2018 in Milan. So these are the types of curiosity that have been identified. There are others, but these are kind of major things. Now, before I go into the actual research into curiosity, as I was writing this, I was thinking to myself, there are two people that to me stand out as being so exceptionally curious that I had to kind of look more deeply into them and see what was it that, you know, was driving them and so on. And this is one of them, Leonardo da Vinci, of course. So Leonardo da Vinci was called by Kenneth Clark the most relentlessly curious man in history. And indeed, you know, of course, he did lots of works of art. He did many drawings for many inventions, for war, for peace, and so on. But what is most amazing are his notebooks. His notebooks, we have now today about 6,500 pages or so. It is thought that there were 15,000 or so pages that he filled. All of them were filled with drawings and writing, all kinds of notes. The notes were all written with the left hand from right to left and in mirror image. So to read it, you actually need to hold a mirror to the page. Now, when you look at these two pages, for example, you at first get the impression that this is all a collection of unrelated doodles. But if you look a little bit more carefully, you start to see some sort of guiding principles here. So first of all, there are a variety of geometrical curves. Then there are things that have to, like these water flows. There are these clouds that have these curves in them. There is the hair of this old gentleman that has the hair, these curves in them. And then there is also the phenomenon of branching, like here in this kind of plant and in this tree here. And I don't know if you can see it, but the branches of the tree transform into the veins of the person here. So there are curves and branching. So one can speculate that the way his mind worked was something like this. He would start thinking about one phenomenon, let's say, you know, water waves and things like that. But then he was very visually a visual person. So immediately he transformed that into a curve, a geometrical curve. Once he did that, he started thinking, in what other phenomena do I see curves like this? And then he, you know, went to clouds, and then he went to this, and so on. So you can almost follow his curiosity through these different subjects. Now, on what was Leonardo curious about? About everything. It was just unbelievable. You know, we know actually which books he had at one point in his life. They cover every almost discipline that was known at that time. If there was one thing he wasn't interested in, it was politics. And that was very, very clever of him, because you know who were the rulers at this time? The Borgias. They just killed everybody who got into politics. On the other hand, they funded Leonardo, so it was great. So that's that. Now, he was also very, very interested in anatomy, and in particular in the human heart. He discovered new things about the human heart. Unlike other people in his time that were dissecting only to prove that Galen from ancient Greece was correct, he dissected to find out what's going on. And he discovered the atria of the heart and their role. He discovered what causes heat, you know, for the body and things like that. Just look at this. It's amazing. Both the drawings and the text that goes with them. He did not discover that there is a circulatory system, because he could never see. He never dissected a live person, so he never saw that. That was left for William Harvey to discover. The second person I looked at that was incredibly curious was Richard Feynman. He was a legendary physicist, a person who has been sometimes called the Sherlock Holmes of physics, because, you know, Sherlock Holmes, you know, he would look at me and he would say, oh, you were born in so-and-so, and your wife likes that, and this, that. All of this he could see from my elbows, from, oh, I don't know, the way I dress, things like that. Feynman could see clues like this in physics that nobody else could see. It was amazing. He, of course, besides the physics, he was a bongo drummer. He was cracking safes. He was, and he started to learn how to draw from his friend Zwartian, who was a painter. He started to learn how to draw. If you take a page from Feynman's notebook, it looks something like this. Just look at this. Now, look, the mathematics is, of course, much more complicated than in Leonardo's. The drawings are much worse than in Leonardo's. But overall, it gives you the same feel. These pages could all have almost been taken from the same notebooks. You know, both of them basically said, everything is interesting if you get into it deeply enough. Okay, now what about these researchers in curiosity? So there is this psychologist, George Loewenstein, is still very much active and alive, from Carnegie Mellon University. And he published this model of curiosity, which was called the information gap model. The idea was the following, that when you encounter something that kind of disagrees with things you know, or at least think you know, a gap is somehow formed. And that gap is felt as an aversive state, as an unpleasant state. And that curiosity's role is simply to take you out of that unpleasantness. That's this model, okay? So curiosity in this sense is a bit like an itch that you need to scratch to get rid of. Now, together with that comes this property that if you look at curiosity as a function of knowledge, then it generates this inverted U-shaped type curve, meaning when you know about something very, very little, you're not curious about it because you don't know what to be curious about. When you know about something a lot, you're also not curious about it because you feel that you already know everything that needs to be known. When do you really get curious? When you know something about the subject, but you know or feel that there is more to be known. That's when you are really curious, okay? So that was his model for curiosity. Now, believe it or not, something very bizarre happened. A former Secretary of Defense of ours, Donald Rumsfeld, in one particular press conference, without knowing about curiosity and not referring to curiosity and nothing like this, sort of captured this property of curiosity, but talking about something completely different. Namely, he was specifically asked in that press conference, what about the fact that they did not find any evidence that Iraq was transferring weapons of mass destruction to terrorist organizations? And this was his answer.
There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
That was his answer, okay? Now, he was given, there is a British organization that gives a foot in the mouth award. And they gave him in 2012 the Foot in the Mouth Award for this, or for being the most baffling statement by a politician. They said, we think we know what he wants to say, but we're not sure we know, they said. Now, I will tell you, after all of this, that, okay, this was a baffling statement as an answer to that particular question. But the statement itself is actually perfectly logical. There are things we know. There are things that we don't know. And there are things that we don't know. I mean, the statement itself is logical, only it didn't quite answer the question there. But it actually captured very nicely this U-shaped curve. Because you see, the things we know, are when we know everything about it, we're not curious. The things we don't know, are when we really don't know almost anything and we're also not curious. We're curious about the known unknowns, namely about those things we know that we don't know. But by the way, I'll just mention that the runner-up for that year for the Foot in the Mouth Award was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who said that, I think that gay marriage is something between a man and his wife. And actually, I think he should have gotten the first prize, because Rumsfeld's statement was actually at least logical. That one was a bit bizarre. Anyhow, people have now can do also experiments in neuroscience. And people have done experiments to test this idea of information gap. And this experiment was done by a Dutch neuroscientist, Marieke Jepma. And the way they did this, now they tested specifically perceptual curiosity, namely that curiosity when you see something ambiguous or puzzling. And the way they did this is they showed the subjects blurred images of known objects to make them curious about what those things were, and then they showed them later what the object was. But they did this while the people were stuck into a functional MRI machine so that they could tell which regions of their brains were activated when they were curious and when their curiosity was relieved. And the interesting thing is that they discovered that the parts of the brains that were activated under perceptual curiosity, this very particular curiosity, were indeed the parts of the brain that are associated with conflict or with hunger or with thirst. So indeed, in the case of perceptual curiosity, it appears that it is indeed associated with an unpleasant state, and the brain regions that are activated are those that are activated when we experience this type of unpleasant state. Now, a different experiment by a woman named Kang and her collaborator tried to test epistemic curiosity, namely this love of knowledge, wanting to learn. And the way they did that is by presenting the subjects with trivia questions, a series of 40 trivia questions. For example, you know, they would ask the subjects, which musical instrument was invented in order to sound like a human voice? Do you know which one, by the way? The violin. So anyhow, so they made people epistemically curious this way and looked what parts of the brain were then activated. And the parts that were activated in this case were different parts, were the parts that are activated in anticipation of reward. These are the parts that are activated when, you know, I say that I'm going to give you a piece of chocolate. Or when you sit in the theater in a play that you wanted to see for a long time just before the curtain goes up. Things like that. So that's epistemic curiosity. And it is associated with a pleasurable state and activates parts of the brain that are in anticipation of reward. In other words, perceptual curiosity and epistemic curiosity appear to be rather different things. One is associated with an unpleasant state, the other with a pleasurable state, and they even activate brain regions accordingly. It's almost like, I'm almost tempted to say that had we known these things in advance, we might have even not called the two things curiosity. We might have given them different names. But, you know, that's how things work. Okay, I've shown you all kinds of things here. I do want to also leave quite a bit of time for questions. So I'm going to skip now quite a few slides. No. Look, we will stay here way too long if I will go through this whole thing. I'm going to skip quite a few things, but I will go to a place where I want to say something, first of all, about curiosity and fear. While writing this book, I coined a phrase which I'm truly very proud of. I'm serious about this. I coined the phrase, curiosity is the best remedy for fear. Curiosity is the best remedy for fear. Now, why do I say that? You see, we very often fear things that we don't know or don't understand. And in order to overcome those, what we need to do is learn more about those things, be curious about them, okay? Now, throughout history, there have been regimes, rulers, sometimes the church, unfortunately, that try to build wall around certain types of knowledge and try to actually suppress curiosity. And even in fairy tales, I mean, this is Hansel and Gretel, you know, there are some fairy tales that don't exactly encourage curiosity. You see, Hansel and Gretel went to explore in the forest, found a house made of candy, wanted to taste it, you know, and so on. What happened? They fell into the hands of a cannibalistic witch. So this is not strong encouragement for curiosity or exploration, right? But it's more than this. Look, all medieval times corresponded to a suppression of curiosity, but not only medieval times. In 1937, the Nazis organized the Degenerate Art Exhibit in Munich, which basically was supposed to convince the people that all modern art was just some conspiracy by communist Jews against the German people. This is Goebbels visiting that exhibit. The Taliban, you know what
so
they did?
So purist, they dynamited all statues.
Look,
last March. As
these statues, you see
including
this?
2,000-year-old stone Buddhas carved
these
into
are, These are the Buddhas of Bamiyan. This is from the 6th century. Hundreds of feet tall statues. They dynamited them. Why? You of course, know that, you know, ISIS destroyed artworks in Palmyra and things like this. And, of course, worst of all, the Taliban attacked Malala Yousafzai because she advocated education for young Pakistani girls. Luckily, you know, they shot her in the head. Luckily, she survived, went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And just about 4 weeks ago, she actually finished her studies. So it's amazing that, you know, but all of this was against curiosity. Now, finally, what I want to tell you is I've also interviewed 9 people that I see as extraordinarily curious in the book, and I just want to run through them very, very quickly. So I'll tell you their names, and then I'll tell you about a few of them, who they are. Here they are. So this is Freeman Dyson, a very famous physicist. This is Noam Chomsky. This is astronaut Story Musgrave. This is Fabiola Gianotti. This is Marilyn Vos-Savant. This is Jack Horner, Martin Rees, Lord Martin Rees, I should say, Brian May, and Vic Muniz. These are the people I interviewed. Let me just tell you who they are. So, for example, Vic Muniz is a Brazilian artist who is one of the most imaginative artists that I've ever seen. What he does is he takes very well-known works of art, let's say the Mona Lisa, okay, and reproduces it, but extremely accurately, let's say from ketchup, mustard, and diamonds. You know, things like that. And he does this with all kinds of works of art. You know, you just cannot imagine. He used garbage, you know, near Rio, you know, to reproduce incredible works of art. I showed you Fabiola Gianotti. She's the director general of CERN, the Center for Nuclear Research in Europe, you know, where the Large Hadron Collider is. And she led one of the two teams that discovered the Higgs boson. But her first degree was in music. She's an accomplished pianist. So not just physics. I showed you Brian May. Brian May was the lead, is still, the, because they sometimes are still appear, the lead Queen guitarist for the rock band Queen. But he's also a PhD in astrophysics. He was the chancellor of a university. He's a big, big activist for the rights of animals. He's a true expert in Victorian stereophotography. Victorian stereophotography. It's these two images which you look with a viewer and you see it in three dimensions. So these are these people. Marilyn Vos-Savant, I showed you. She writes the column Ask Marilyn in Parade magazine. But, you know, she never finished even an undergraduate degree. But she has the highest ever recorded IQ of any person. 228 IQ. Yeah, I just want to remind you that 140 is considered a genius. Okay, now, to be fair, the tests are completely useless when you reach those types of scales, but it's still she's still very, very up there, okay? So these are these people. Okay, Let me finish with coming back to my friend Leonardo, who said once, blinding ignorance does mislead us. O wretched mortals, open your eyes. And indeed, my scientific icon, Albert Einstein, kept opening his eyes. Here he does it once and twice and thrice. Thank you very much. Can I have the lights, please? So I'll be happy to answer questions, and then we'll sign books. So are there any questions? Yes. If somebody is naturally curious, what would be acting to suppress their curiosity? That's what you're asking. So first of all, indeed, curiosity is largely genetic. It is not only genetic, but like all psychological traits, it has a large genetic component that is well known. Now, what would be us doing to suppress that curiosity? So, in the Middle Ages, for example, Church Orthodoxy assumed that the Ptolemaic model of the solar system, which had the Earth at the center, was the correct model, and nobody was allowed to talk against it. Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake for it, So that acts to suppress your curiosity. Galileo was tortured by the Inquisition. That is a big suppression of curiosity. But what else acts to suppress curiosity? Not just for an individual, but even for a society. I'll tell you what. Eliminating funding for the endowment for the arts acts to suppress curiosity. Eliminating funding for NPR suppresses curiosity. Cutting budgets for the NIH suppresses curiosity. Okay? So there are many things that can be done by individuals or atmospherically or governments or things like that that suppress curiosity. Other questions? Yes. Is curiosity contagious?
Yes, sir.
Yes. So it is very interesting. You didn't read my book yet, right?
No.
The sentence before last. The book, by the way, just appeared last week. Yes, it's hot off the press, literally. It appeared last Tuesday, so 9 days ago, okay? The sentence before last, I said, they say that curiosity is contagious. In that case, I say, let's turn it into an epidemic. How can you encourage curiosity? Yes, and nourish curiosity and so on. So there are a number of ways. So you start, first of all, with small children, yes? They ask many questions. You encourage them to ask many questions. You don't say, oh, stop asking me all this, yes? Not only that, what you do is, suppose they ask you, why is that and that, yes? Something, why is that? Don't give immediately the answer. Say, why do you think is that and that? And let them say something, and then say, if that's the case, then if I do this, that should happen. And let them see it for themselves. So that's one thing. Second thing, follow their curiosity. I'll give you an example. You see, we all want our kids to learn science and things like this and things, right? But sometimes the curriculum is a bit silly, to be honest. Because the curriculum, let's say the curriculum says that all children need to know about the free fall acceleration on Earth, okay? Let's say, yes? But most kids are not that interested about that. But most kids, at least most American kids, are fascinated by dinosaurs, right? Yes. So start with dinosaurs. Start your science lessons with dinosaurs and talk about dinosaurs and teach them about dinosaurs. And then you can say, and you know what? The dinosaurs all became extinct. And you know why they became extinct? Because an asteroid came from space and hit the Earth. It accelerated towards the Earth. So you can bring in what you thought was important through the curiosity that they already have. Just reminds me, there is a phrase in German, warum, warum is die Banane krumm? Why is the banana curved? Yes. There are two questions here. So one, curiosity killed the cat. The original phrase, which comes from the 16th century, said care killed the cat. And care meant grief. And somewhere at the end of the 19th century, that turned into curiosity killed the cat. And I'm not sure why it turned into that. But that's part of that thing that tries to suppress curiosity. Now, you asked about what? Yes, animal curiosity. Yes, about animal curiosity. Yes. Okay, so animals are curious, but humans are the only ones who are capable of asking why. And I actually describe experiments that shows that, demonstrate that humans are the only ones who are able to ask why. And that's why the book is called Why, because that's really unique to humans. Yeah. Yes, you know, for people who are interested in many things, is there a point where it becomes a distraction? Perhaps at the very extreme edge of that may be ADHD. You know, where people just cannot focus on one thing and they have attention deficit disorder, where they all the time are attracted to something else. That may be, I'm not sure, but I talked to some experts on this and they said that one could regard this as an extreme, as curiosity sort of stuck on spinning gears, if you like. So that is possible. Now, it is absolutely true that for people to make genuine contributions, they must have at least one area in which they actually are able to focus and do something about it. Yes, Leonardo, for example, was famous for not finishing most of his projects. I actually speculate in the book that he may have had ADHD. He almost never finished anything. But still, when he was very curious about something, he was able to focus and finish it. And it didn't happen often, but it did happen. So yes, I think one does need to, at some level, you know, say, okay, but if you want to really do something, then please focus on this for a while. It has a genetic component. It's not 100% genetic, but it has a genetic component. Is it also tied to intelligence? Yes, there is a correlation. Exactly how does one influence the other? I don't exactly know. Maybe it has to do with the fact that the mechanisms that drive curiosity, first of all, are based in the striatum, which is underneath the cerebral cortex, and some components of intelligence also reside in those general areas. That is one possibility. And there are other connections that may be between the two in terms of if you are very curious, it means that you're also able to process information very, very well. And that may be in itself related to intelligence because, you know, if you want to be, you have to assign value to knowledge. And if you assign value to knowledge, then you have to be able to process a lot of information. By the way, I should make one clarifying statement. My writing style is very concise. I've always known that. It's true even in when I write scientific papers. I mean, where somebody might write five paragraphs, I write one sentence. This sometimes it's sometimes not so good, yes? But look, as a result of this, the book is not very thick. And the thing is, you see that about a third of it actually is the end notes that I put and the bibliography, which is enormous. My feeling is actually that this is not bad for a modern reader who, you know, on one hand wants to finish the book, and if they get really, really interested in the more things, then, you know, they can read all the notes and all the bibliography associated with it. But sometimes this is taken by some people in the wrong way. They say that, you know, I wrote about this superficially. If you'll just look at the number of bibliography here, you will see that there is nothing superficial about this. It's just that I really have a very concise style. There is no question. I think you heard her, right? If we didn't have curiosity, would we become extinct? Well, there is no question about this, that curiosity evolved largely because of survival. Yes, I mean, of course, we had to understand our environment. We had to understand cause and effect in order to actually be able to survive. There is no question about this. We had to, at some point, you know that if you walk off the cliff, things that are not so good happen. So of course, it was important in that. However, this cannot be the whole story, because we as humans have always been curious in many more things than those needed for survival. I can say that especially because I work in theoretical astrophysics. Most of my work, you know, may become one day with applications. But certainly when I do this work, I only do it for curiosity. It does not have any direct immediate applications, if I will understand that the cosmic expansion is accelerating or not. Yes? So, yeah. Maybe we'll take a couple more questions. Do we understand, you know, what turns the mind into various types of curiosity and so on? Of course we don't. I mean, this is one of the things. I mean, what you're asking is, do we fully understand consciousness? And we don't, really. So, you know, we can look at various things, but no. You know, Einstein's brain has been analyzed to death to find all kinds of things in it, because especially there was this pathologist that kept his brain in a jar for years without telling anybody. But at the end he told, and, you know, they took some cuts, and they really have shown nothing convincing about, you know, what was special about his brain. His brain, for example, was smaller than the average. We really don't know these things with a mirror. So I discussed this in the book too. So there is a conspiratorial theory, but there is a very simple explanation. He was left-handed, and for left-handed, had he written from left to right normally, his hand would have smeared the ink. So it was much easier for him to write like that. I'm not an expert in the psychology of ants, but I believe that ants basically are interested in two things: in preserving their queen, in building their house, and in getting food. So all they do is towards that thing. Now, how they sense the food so quickly is to me, it's a mystery, but I'm sure that it has been studied by many other researchers.
I mean,
because sometimes, you know, you just leave something there for, you know, an hour, and already the ants know and they come. So clearly they smell, or, you know, in some sense. Well, yeah, they sometimes stop and look as if they are exchanging some form of information. I'm sure they are not talking about the weather. Thank you all very much. I will sign books.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation, and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.